Part 6. Spare Time Hobby. Millions met Swami Prabhavananda through his books. It might have been more accurate to have begun this account in that way, for even if we come to know a writer in person, we form a mental set about him when we read him first. In the Philadelphia Center on my first visit, lacking the money to buy the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna with which I was acquainted, I had purchased the Eternal Companion, about which I knew nothing. The book became a kind of second Bible for me, and surely it has been so for many others. In his presentation of the life and teachings of Maharaj, Swami has subtly, almost seductively, enticed the skeptic or agnostic to admire this portrait of contemplation and to entertain the possibility of relating oneself to God, the person. The very first thing that Swami Brahmananda says in that book is that God is. This was what caught Gerald Hurd, and for him, everything changed. As I made my way west, I carried with me, as well as the other small volume, which had recently come out, the Bhagavad Gita translation, first fruit of Prabhupada Swami's collaboration with Isherwood. When Swami Vishwananda of the Chicago Center, the second Swami I called on, saw it in my hand, he praised it highly. "I am so glad they have done this," he said. "You have done well to buy it. You see, they have tried to reproduce something of the original style of the Gita, a measure of prose and a measure of poetry. You like the 2 meters in the Sanskrit." It is not my intention to try to cover or review Swami Prabhavananda's phenomenal literary output. That is not within my competency, nor was I witness to much of its making. Of all his original volumes, collaborations, translations, magazine articles, and editing, very little, I believe, was done at Tribhuvan, nor did he discuss it with us, except now and then. I remember that the table talk for a couple of meals in his presence consisted of our knocking around the question of the best title for the Yoga Sutras translation, which he and Chris were about to complete. How to know God was what Chris finally wished to settle upon. And some of us thought that it was a mistake. But who were we? Swami's capacity to push on with the literary work must have been immense. In 1968, when he was 75 years old, he wrote to me, "For some weeks I was too busy in Hollywood. Every moment of my time was taken up reading proof of a new book. A collection of some of my lectures is titled Religion in Practice. Chris has written a beautiful introduction to the book. Alan and Unwin will be publishing from England and Vedanta Press from here. The publication date is June 6th. 4 years earlier, in another letter, he had said, "No, there can be no real retirement for any of the older Swamis until they either become invalid or die. The older you are, the greater the demand. Such is the lot of the Swami." Even a sample of the fruit of this prodigious labor must be struck by the simplicity of the Swami's style. The total absence of academic pretension and literary conceit. His English, even without a collaborating polisher, was excellent for its purposes. It was not a studied technique. He spoke and thought in the same way. The reading of one book or two may thus mislead one into supposing that he had only an average education and was not deep or wide in his scholarship. Well, a perusal of the biblical supports of his Sermon on the Mount, or the homework buried in the spiritual heritage of India, quickly dissolves any such notion. It was the same with Swami Vivekananda, who was a devourer of encyclopedias, but whose style is even now too simple and academically unsophisticated for the literary world to be bothered with. Swami Prabhupada never paraded his scholarship. In all my notes, I have been hard put to dredge up one which even hints at his considerable erudition. But here it is. Quote, "Yes, Hegel arrived at a logical proof of the absolute. But how do we know that the conception of the absolute tallies with the fact of the absolute? And one can realize the absolute as a fact. But there, no logical formulation of it can be made. If one were, it would not be the absolute." It almost makes one feel it was the Swami who was really getting the point of existentialism. The spiritual heritage of India came to be used as a textbook in the 60s and 70s for courses in comparative religion at numerous colleges and universities, especially in the Midwest. With regard to his translations from Sanskrit, these can be no exception to the observation that any translator is an interpreter. Unambiguous one-on-one equivalence exists between scarcely any languages so distantly related. By choosing from a set of near synonyms those which most nearly express his own understanding, the translator inevitably recolors and redefines the original thought. Quote, "Very faithful and almost literal," end of quote, is the way in which Swami Prabhupada's translations were described by one Sanskrit scholar. I think the description too strong, but be that as it may, he was both consciously and unconsciously aware of Western taste and expectations, and he knew very well how to fulfill these through the language employed. He understood which sankskaras, impressions of the Western mind and culture would be evoked, which harp strings of the American memory touched, as he wrote, "And all his literary work has this cast to it. It is best seen, perhaps, in The Wisdom of God," that book in which Swami Prabhupada has, without anyone looking over his shoulder, produced a version of the Srimad Bhagavatam, cut and trimmed and tailored to his own specifications and tastes. It is a beautiful and spiritually inspiring work, but a different entity from the original. Whenever a new book would be published, each of us in the monastic family would be presented with a copy paid for by our senior American Swami and inscribed by the author, our abbot. Sometimes this was our first glimpse of the material. But many of these works did appear serially in the pages of Vedanta and the West, the center's bi-monthly journal. Was any other little magazine ever loved as much by its readership? And was there ever greater disappointment than when, unbelievably, Swami terminated its publication. We used to greet each issue's delivery with an unabashed anticipatory excitement, pronouncing upon the color of the jacket and the number of the articles. Numerous shorter ones was the favored format. It was pocket size, and the devotees could carry it off to work, bus, or plane. In this brilliant little periodical could be found for many years the Vedantic musings of Gerald Hurd, Aldous Huxley, John Van Druten, Christopher Isherwood, John Yale, Dorothy Mercer, and Nancy Mayorga, as well as gleanings from the disciples of the Master and speeches and writings by Swami Prabhavananda himself and other Swamis of the order. This corpus of material, comprising 32 years of publication, is a mine of spiritual gold and a treasure of recondite information. Some of us, too, would write for Vedanta and the West, as requested by the editors, and there was naturally a special anticipation in the heart when what could easily be one's sole adventure into print was about to appear. But when most of the really good writers who had addressed themselves to Vedantic themes, not only in our publications, but to the world at large as well, witness the perennial philosophy, had passed on, having made their contributions to the burgeoning interest in mysticism and the East of the 50s and the 60s, times changed. Swami's paramount feeling seems to have been that the journal had played its role. Swami Prabhavananda's literary accomplishment extends to more than what first appears on examination. In addition to the titles which bear his name as author, there are the two compilations of essays, Vedanta for the Western World and Vedanta for Modern Man, in the selection and editing of which his hand was present. There is also his indubitable influence in Isherwood's biography, Ramakrishna and His Disciples, not to mention My Guru and His Disciple and other writings, and in a less direct way in many of the writings of Hurd, Huxley, and John Yale. In 1958, that Chris was reading aloud to them the first chapter of the life of Ramakrishna which he was writing. Swami said, "It is excellent, a very dramatic beginning. It grips you immediately." Chris asked for criticism from the audience, but all remained silent, spellbound. The only remark was, "We wish we could hear the whole life read." End of letter. I was not witness to any extent to Swami's relations with Gerald and Aldous. The closeness of the former's identification with the Vedanta Center was lessening when I arrived, and he was withdrawing from Tribhuvan. For a couple of years, until his untimely death, John Van Druten gave us the pleasure of his company now and then. He was open, rather like a child, in Swami's presence, one of those great men around whom one never felt uncomfortable. His dedicatory speech on the 4th of July at Tribhuvan was impressive and appreciated. As we sat in the library during this visit with the two Swamis, Van Druten and Isherwood present, the question of whether it is possible to write a successful spiritual drama was explored. I wish I had taken note. I recall that Van Druten seriously doubted it. his play The Moon and Sixpence, his own attempt, recently staged, had folded. Christopher's whole story, in spite of his own successive literary exercises in revealing it, is yet to be told. Though he was with us all innumerable times at the center, his visits to Tribuco were few and not of long duration. Of course, I treasure those for the opportunity they gave me of knowing him well and for catching the sparks from the brilliance of his wit and intellect. I thought of Chris as a good friend, and I believe he considered me his. He was a delight, and for Swami Prabhupada, a magic formula. We would say today that their chemistry was right. It was Chris's conviction that with all the acceptance on Swami's part of this disciple and his controversial nature, a thorough understanding, a complete placing of himself in Chris's point of view, was probably impossible. Whether he was correct or not, who knows? Not that this relationship did not cost Swami something. He, however, never shunned anybody, never avoided people, was never reluctant to be seen in anybody's company. So stupendous is the contribution of the work and service of Isherwood to Vedanta that whatever detracting aspersions may be cast, whatever handicaps in the judgment of the world he may represent, will have one day to be swallowed up in a subsuming of acceptance or forgiveness. This will be history's assessment, I am sure. A letter Swami wrote to me in November of 1963 should dispel any supposition that Isherwood's Vedanta writing helped to fill his own pocket. Quote, Christopher Krishnananda, the senior American Swami of the Center, and I will be leaving for India on December 18th and will arrive in Calcutta on the 21st. Swamiji's centenary committee have been urging Chris and me to come during Parliament of Religions to be held in Calcutta from December 30th to January 5th. Chris will preside one day and I will have to preside another day. They were even willing to pay our expenses. I refused to accept, but Chris had to accept because he has no money. This year he devoted himself completely to finishing writing The Life of the Master. He did not have time to earn any money for himself. He is now revising the book, and the manuscript will be ready before we leave for India. The publishers in America and England will give substantial advance royalty as soon as they receive the manuscript. If they would not accept it, the Vedanta Society will receive the royalties. Is it possible to be totally objective regarding the nature of one's own drift and leanings? It seems doubtful. While editing the London magazine Vedanta for East and West, which, by the way, had been started with Swami's magazine as an evident model, I received from Hollywood his letter of complaint about unorthodoxy, from which this extract I quote. In your last issue, I felt disappointed to see another article written by some professor who suggests modernizing Vedanta, and all his ideas seem to me nonsensical. I would have refused to publish such an ignorant article. Don't mind my criticism. The scholars, so-called, live in theories, never apply the truths of Vedanta. Ready to give advice, God bless him. End of quote. Was he unaware of the extent of his own bending, perhaps in other directions, but in some sense modernizing of Vedanta?